Okay, so last week we talked about Tevila and the extent to which that has to be in front of Beis Din, and also what does it mean for that to be in front of Beis Din. So we're going to segue from that into the question of Beis Din overall and the role of Beis Din in the Giyur process, both conceptually and practically, and some of the issues. And just as a alert, this is a topic of tremendous controversy. There's a lot of controversy in Geiris, but there are probably three or four separate controversies that emerge from this topic. Last week's topic also involved controversy. There's a lot of controversies in Geiris, but this is a topic which brings about a lot of serious controversy. And we'll note the controversy. We're not necessarily going to take a stand on some of these issues, but just to be aware of what are some of the issues that have brought about some contested conclusions, particularly in contemporary Geiris. So we know that the Gemara tells us that we've seen a few times, it's one of the sources that we have to keep coming back to, that the Gemara in Yevamos on Daf Memvav Midbeis tells us that a Geir requires a Beis Din because it is called Mishpat. And there's a lot to ask about what exactly that requirement involves. And first, let's consider just conceptually, why is there a Beis Din involved in Geiris? Okay, so the Gemara tells us that it has this Mishpat connection. Does that mean that it actually is a judgment of some kind? Or is it something that we can derive from a connection to Mishpat, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the process is one of Mishpat? And we'll see, it actually makes a big difference. Moshe?
Yeah, just practically, you don't want like people running around saying that they're all Geirim, that they all converted without any people knowing that they converted. So wouldn't it be just practically make sense that Beis Din needs to be part of it, just so we know who actually is a Geirim? Huh?
Okay, so you're highlighting one of the themes, right, that clearly there is a public element here, and clearly this is something which impacts on the tzibur and the interaction with the tzibur. So it's not like whether you took a lulav or whether you put on tefillin this morning that we need to require a Beis Din for those things because there's some kind of public issue. So we understand intuitively that certain religious concepts can be just between you and God, and certain things are not. So here this is something which clearly impacts the tzibur. So certainly from that perspective, doesn't it make sense that there should be some role that the tzibur is formally informed about what's going on? So clearly there's truth to that. And the question is it only that, or is it more than that? Or is it that and other things? So there's a lot that's suggested about this. Moshe, you changed your name. It says Moshe Annapol.
Brother.
Yeah, I know. So that Moshe is a popular name here, but you're feeling the peer pressure? We could have a Beis Din of three Moshes. Sorry?
I had to join in, you know.
Got it. Okay. You know, that's it's actually Shaila in Beis Din, you know, whether the two or Machria the third, whether the Tosa says that the third, like, he loses his identity to the other two, so you can become a Moshe too. Okay. Yes?
Isn't that why, for example, in Israel, the Rabbanut has a registry for, you know, weddings and divorces and also for conversions, because they want to make it more of a tzibur aspect, and also it's easier when it's part of that, you know, registry, if you want to call it that.
Well, so that's clearly an issue, right? Certainly this is an issue that impacts the tzibur, and it's understandable that this is a matter of public status, and that anything that would have a secular parallel, if there was some kind of a, you know, in America, so the government's not involved in a religion, but we understand issues of marriage and divorce and the like, so certainly you need a public voice and you need a public context. So it wouldn't surprise us that there's got to be some kind of a public involvement here as well. So the question is that the whole story? Or is there more to it? So there are various perspectives on what exactly conceptually is involved, hashkafically is involved, in the Beis Din. Rav Soloveitchik and his drushes, actually published in Al HaTshuva, He talks about how the idea of entering into the Jewish people is a sealing of a bris with the Shekhinah, and therefore we need a representation of the Shekhinah. So it makes sense that we should have the Beis Din Elokim Nitzav Ba'ad Hizkel, that we have God's presence. The Gemara says in Maseches Brachos that when a Beis Din convenes, the Shekhinah is there. So we need to have some kind of representation of the Shekhinah. So a Beis Din could make sense from that context. And in this sense, he is echoing his namesake and great-grandfather, the original Rabbi Sheber Soloveitchik, in the Beis Halevi Al HaTorah, in Parshas Lech Lecha. So there the Beis Halevi makes a similar point, specifically talking about the Mila of Avraham Avinu, that he says that when it comes to Avraham Avinu, he was essentially dealing directly with God and entering into a bris with him. And God says, okay, now this is going to be the deal going forward, and you are empowered to represent the Shekhinah now also through your bris. That's the basic idea. So we can't get Avraham Avinu to come to a contemporary Geirus, but we can get a Beis Din, and that perhaps the Beis Din has that role to represent the Shekhinah that is entering into a covenant with this Geirus candidate. Rav Shechter Shlita in a Sefer Ginas Egos, so he emphasizes this theme as well. This is in Simud Lamed Hei, and he uses this to address the question of, and he uses this to make some halachic points also that we'll come back to, but just as far as explaining the framework, that this is the idea. One could ask two questions. One could say that if we're deriving everything from Maimed Har Sinai, so then how do we get this idea of a requirement of Beis Din, which wasn't part of Maimed Har Sinai? And Taka, if it wasn't, so how did the Jews convert at Maimed Har Sinai? You're not going to say that Moshe Rabbeinu was the Sanhedrin. I mean, we sometimes, or it was the Beis Din. I mean, we sometimes find that he was B'makom Ayin Aleph, that he represented the 71 Dayanim of the Sanhedrin. But if you're going to go down that route, so then you're going to require an entire Sanhedrin for every Geirus. So that's not going to be the explanation. So how do we answer that? So as he notes, you could say essentially that one question answers the other, that the purpose of the Beis Din is to represent the Shekhinah, and therefore it has a role which at Har Sinai was played by the experience itself. So when God was giving us the Torah at Har Sinai, so there was the Shekhinah, so we don't need a Beis Din. But now we need a Beis Din to evoke that same type of experience. He quotes there Reb Shul Mikutno in a Sefer on Choshen Mishpat, where he's addressing additional questions, whether you can force a Beis Din to accept something against its will. So this notion the Beis Din represents the Shekhinah would seem to mitigate against that. And so too, that's the idea here, that the Beis Din is the Shekhinah, and the Beis Din is essentially making the deal. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, in the Tshuvas Chavis Binyamin, so he has a different focus, which could also affect things, and he emphasizes that Gemara that we've seen a few times, and will come up again today a few times, the Gemara in Kiddushin and Daf Samach Beis, where there the Mishnah says that what would happen if somebody would make a condition, he wants to marry a woman, but he's not Jewish or she's not Jewish, and he says that, okay, this should take place after the conversion. And there the Gemara asserts that we don't call that biyado. It's not that he has the control to just convert whenever he wants, because a Beis Din is going to have to agree to deal with him. So Rav Shaul Yisraeli emphasizes from there in the Chavis Binyamin that you see that it's not just there has to be a Beis Din and he can just come in front of the Beis Din. They have to agree. And he connects this to go back to day one of our discussions. He connects this to the idea of the Kabbalah of the Beis Din, that the Beis Din has to accept the Ger. And we spoke about on day one what exactly that means, the Beis Din being Mekabel, the Ger, and what that process is. So here, his understanding is to take that idea a little further, to say that a ger, in order to become a ger, has to be welcomed into Klal Yisrael. That the Jewish people have to bring him in. And therefore, we need the Beis Din to represent the Klal as far as that's concerned. So it's not something that can happen against their will. So this individual is trying to make a condition to say, listen, I can just grab any three Jews and convert in front of them. It doesn't work that way. They're going to have to be mekabel him. Rav Zsolti, Rav Yaakov Batzal Zsolti, is the author of the Sefer Mishnas Yavetz, and wrote about this. I think we made reference in the past to the edition of the Torah Shebaal Peh journal, which has a collection of articles on Geirus. And there, Rav Zsolti asserts that if they're going to be a Beis Din, so they have to be knowingly constituted as a Beis Din in order to be mekabel gerim. Otherwise, it's not going to have a status of a Beis Din, and the whole process is not going to work. So one of the questions that Rishonim deal with, and I gave you a few makoros to look at this morning, is the question of, does the Beis Din have to involve smuchim? And do they have to be ordained dayanim? And if so, l'chara, we have a problem, which is not to undermine the wonderful smicha program, which we're connected to here, and which some of you are a part of, which is one of the greatest smicha programs around today, but emphasis today. So nowadays we don't have classical smicha anymore. We know we don't have smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu, which means, practically speaking, we don't have smuchim in the halachic sense. So when there is a halachic requirement for smicha, we don't have that anymore. Again, not to devalue the smicha that you guys are getting, but it's a different kind of concept. Tyler, you have a question about that? You want to pull out of the smicha program? They didn't tell you? Okay, because it's still, again, it's still the best smicha program around today. It's just, we're all on a different level.
Right. I was going to ask the level that they were on back then. When did that level end?
So the Gemara talks about that whole story about how that ended because of the persecution, because they weren't able to keep giving it ish mipi ish. The whole discussion to be had about what it would take to revive it. So that's a fascinating discussion itself, a whole Chiddush HaSmicha controversy, if it's possible. That's a little bit outside our scope. I'm happy to talk about that at greater length. But what we do know is that right now we don't have it. So again, something personal, you can't get it anywhere. I mean, when there was original smicha, so then you could only get it in Eretz Yisrael. So then you could have a time that maybe you should go to Gross to get it. But nowadays you can't get it in Eretz Yisrael either. So the question is, what do we do about that? Moshe, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, because we mentioned the words in the Pasuk of the Dor Techem. So how does that impact the idea of having smuchim? Because
exactly. So this is what the Rishonim deal with. So if you saw Tosfos in Gittin and Tosfos in Yevamos and the Rashba, the Rishonim try to figure this out. Shlomo/Moshe, you want to comment on that?
I just want to make sure, when we're talking about the question of smuchim, not experts, right?
So that's also relevant. You know, how to what degree do you have to be an expert is also a question. But before we can even get to that, so what if you're the biggest Talmud Chacham in the world, but you're the biggest Talmud Chacham in the world today, so you're not a Samuch. So if we don't have actual Smuchim, does that matter? So it seems like it's a problem, which Moshe Dechter was just starting to ask and the Rishonim bring up, that we know we have a problem on the surface, because if you're going to tell me we need smuchim, so then we got a problem, because on the one hand we don't have smuchim today, but on the other hand we've established that we always have to be able to have gerim. So that's why we know at least the Gemara says we can have a ger without a karbon. It's been invoked in a few other contexts that we've seen also. So if we need smuchim, so doesn't that create a big problem for us? How can we have gerim b'zman hazeh, which we know, as a matter of principle, has to be possible? So how can we do that if we don't have smuchim? So you have two answers, basically, in the Rishonim. One is that, okay, you don't need smuchim. Not every bezdin needs smuchim, which may itself say something about what exactly this bezdin is doing. And then whether it need to be knowledgeable or not will be a next level question. But there's also a way to deal with the smuchim, with the requirement of smuchim. So if you learn the first Mishnah in Sanhedrin, so and the first sugya in Sanhedrin, so what emerges is that there's a way to have the power of smuchim functioning b'zman hazeh. Because the first Mishnah in Sanhedrin talks about all the different kinds of batei din that could exist for dinei mamonos and for nefashos and for onshin, etc., etc. Whole history behind this. If you ever, if we had the time to talk about it, to get into the fascinating discussion about the attempt to revive smicha 500 years ago for the purposes of onshin. But what about, for example, for basic dinei Torah functions? So the Mishnah tells us we're going to need a qualified bezdin to address issues of monetary halacha. And if you're not going to have that, so then we're going to be in trouble. So we're not going to have people willing to get involved in monetary interactions. People are not going to make loans because they're not going to have any recourse because there's no functioning bezdin. So we need to have some kind of system. So the Gemara talks about something called shlichusayhu. So on the surface, shlichusayhu sounds like it means shlichus. It sounds like it means that there is some kind of system by which the bezdin that functions nowadays is acting as an agent, as an emissary of the ordained dayanim, and is given their power. Rav Shechter explains at length in one of his svarim, maybe in Bikvei Atzon, it's not actually what shlichusayhu is, even though the language sounds like it's a shlichus, it's something else, it's more of a netilas rishus, it's more of that when you have dayanim smuchim, so then it's usher for the non-smuchim to function in their place. But when there aren't, so then that creates a different structure, and that's what we mean. So the lumdus of shlichusayhu is its own discussion. But what we need to know for our purposes is that there is this concept that allows an extension of the status of smuchim onto contemporary dayanim. So they could conduct a din Torah nowadays based on that authority. But we also find, if you learn these sugyas in Sanhedrin, it comes up in Bava Kamma a lot, that there's limitations on what they can do. That they can only deal with cases that have two elements to them. One, they have to be a milsa de shchicha, has to be something which is a relatively common situation, and then gets into a whole discussion of what exactly is considered common and what isn't. And also, it's got to be something that has chisar and kis, something that has monetary consequences if it wasn't going to be taken care of. So as opposed to knas, the contemporary bezdin is not going to deal with a knas, that's not in the category of mammon, and you can get into some detailed discussions of what meets the standard and what doesn't meet the standard. So Rav Kook has a tshuva, and the tshuva is Das Kohen, it's Kuf Mem Zayin, where he talks about the structure for Geirus. And he says that it must be that Geirus meets the standard. It must be that we're assuming Shlichusayhu is, like some of the Rishonim say, is the path here. And that we are assuming that it meets these two requirements. That first of all, is Geirus common? Is it Shchiach? So maybe it's not. Maybe it's not common, but it's so important that it's equal to it being common. It's the same logic as something being common, that the weight that it has on society, it's as if it happens very frequently. And that addresses the question, or it connects to the question of the need for there always to be a possibility of Geirus, like we said before, that if we're going to say that Geirus has to, by its very nature, always be possible, so then that is going to put it on a level with something that is shchiach. It has to be treated as that kind of a priority. And as far as a loss, so whether it's actually dollars and cents, okay, so it's not money in that sense, but it's equivalent and more than money to say that without the possibility of Geiris, we're not going to allow somebody who's ready to connect to the Shechina to do so. So that's going to have a consequence that's at least as significant as losing money. So we have to say it meets the standard, even though it's in both cases we have to go more to the essence of the standards rather than the details of the standards. But that's essentially what's happening, that Shlichusaihu is allowing the Geiris to work, which again the Rishonim say, Rav Kook is explaining how it fits the rules. And Rav Kook is also making a nafkamina based on that, which is going to be a huge issue. And this is one of the questions which brings up a lot of controversy. But he says, let's say if one is going to convert somebody who is not going to fulfill the mitzvos, so then the question of whether it meets the standards of Shichusayu anymore, that essentially suggesting that there's going to be a flaw in the whole process for that reason, that the justifications to do Geiris Bizman Hazeh and to fit it into a framework of Shlichusayu is premised on the fact that it's going to be a good thing, it's going to be a zchus, it's going to be a merit, that this individual is going to be chayiv the mitzvos. And if that's not the case, then the whole Shlichusayu is flawed. So this gets to the question in general of Batei Din taking on cases of people who won't be observing the mitzvos, which is a controversy within a controversy. And the details of Kabbalah some mitzvos we want to take on separately, probably, God willing, tomorrow. That'll be our topic. But there's a lot of discussion about what is the impact on the Beis Din if the Beis Din accepts the ger who's not ready to be mekabel the mitzvos. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach has a tshuva about this, where he, this is in Tshuvas Mincha Shlomo, has a tshuva where he talks about many different aspects of Lifnei Iver. He has a very often quoted point about Lifnei Iver there. It's about a different aspect of it. But one of the things he talks about is that if a Beis Din is going to convert somebody who's not ready to accept the mitzvos, so then that Beis Din is putting this person in a bad position, putting them in a position where they are essentially going to be tripped up, and that's going to be a violation of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. And then the question is it worse than that? So this is a very tricky point. This was the topic of a huge controversy about 13, 14 years ago. In Eretz Yisrael, a lot has been written about it. And just to really give you only the very, very basic framework of the issue, the question is, if a Beis Din is accepting Geirim, and let's say for argument's sake, they're not requiring acceptance of the mitzvos, maybe that detail was debatable in the cases that were being fought over, but if they do that, so is that itself a violation on the part of the Beis Din? And then if that's the case, does that disqualify the Dayanim? And then what impact would that have even if everything else worked, even if everything else fits? So there's a huge controversy about this, a lot written about this issue, and about whether a Beis Din that doesn't require or doesn't go through the process of Kabbalah some mitzvos or of teaching about the mitzvos that we'll talk about more tomorrow, are they themselves disqualified as Dayanim, and that maybe impacts the whole process. So that there is itself a whole controversy, and that's a subset of a larger controversy. Tyler, a question about that?
Yeah, I was going to raise my hand on that. This is easier. Thank you. I was going to ask, so even if, let's say we don't hold it's okay that the Beis Din accepts these Jews without Kabbalah and Mitzvos, would we still say, but yeah, but it's fine, right? We would still say that it's okay.
Without the Geiris without Kabbalah and Mitzvos?
Yeah, these Jews, yeah.
So that will, you know, the Kabbalah and Mitzvos detail we'll get into tomorrow. So it depends who you ask, that big machlokas. Not everyone says that. There are some who say that, and there are some who don't. So see, it's a big question what exactly to do with that. And beyond this more narrow question of just whether deciding not to insist on Kabbalah Samitzvos in the same way can disqualify you, but what about other things? So are we requiring that a Beis Din only be made up of Orthodox rabbis in good standing? Or what if the Beis Din is not made up of Orthodox rabbis in good standing? So this is a major issue because it goes to the question of how crucial is the Beis Din requirement and what exactly is the Beis Din requirement itself made up of. So everyone would agree, l'chadchila, it's what you want to have on the Beis Din. But if you don't, after the fact, so does that disqualify the Geirus? So this was a big machlokas, and if you saw it put on the Makaris this morning also, that the riff, it sounds like the way the Shulte Gebura reads the riff, that it could be kosher b'dieved without a valid Beis Din. So this was a big dispute, l'halacha, how to relate to this b'dieved of Soloveitchik. It was quoted by Rabbi Wurzberger and others. Rav Schechter quotes by Wurzberger, quoting the Rav in one of his farm, I think in Nefesh HaRav, that he would worry that a conversion with any kind of a Beis Din would possibly be valid and therefore would have ramifications for requiring a get if this individual married a Jewish woman and the like. While others, Rav Moshe Feinstein took a harder line on this and thought that if the Beis Din was made up of Dayanim who were not fully observant and the like, that would for sure disqualify the Geirus, but he also noted that we don't always know that that's really the case. So there could be that even if they're not Orthodox rabbis in good standing, that they are still kosher Dayanim, and we'd still have to be concerned for that perspective. But that if the Dayanim were personally disqualified, that would disqualify the Geirus. So that's a broader machlokas. So just again to restate, so the big controversy a few years ago was even if you do require valid Dayanim, but and you require them to be Orthodox rabbis in good standing, could they lose that standing just because of this? Just because of not requiring Kabbalah Samitzvos in the way that others assume is necessary. That's a more narrow point. But more broadly speaking, just the whole question of how much the personal status of the Dayanim impacts things itself was a broader machlokas. In addition, there's also a question as to whether there's an issue with a ger serving on a Beis Din for gerus. So this was a big machlokas also. Rabbi Yalo was the rabbi in Syracuse, was the father-in-law of Dr. Rosalind Yaslow, who won the Nobel Prize. And her father-in-law was the rabbi in Syracuse, who wrote a sefer called Shalmei Shmuel, where he took the position that a ger could not serve on a Beis Din for geirus. And Shechter quotes this also in his essay in Ginas Egos. And he was medayik, and others would argue on this diuk, but he was medayik from the language of Rashi and Kedushin, that whole passage about the one who made the condition and how do we know he's going to get a Beis Din to deal with him. So Rashi throws in the word Shloshim Yisrael. How do you know he's going to get three from Yisrael, which sometimes means they were born from Yisrael, they're not Gerim. So how do we know that he's going to find such a Beis Din to deal with him? So that diuk is arguable. There's a whole discussion. But this is essentially a big machlokas achronim, that even though there's a question in general, maybe we'll get to this. This is really one of the post-Geirus questions, but here is where it now comes into the Geirus process itself. So there is a whole discussion to be had about a Ger in a position of Minoi, in a position of Srara. If you put a Ger as an authority position, as the rabbi of a shul, or the president of a shul, or a member of a Beis Din. It's a whole discussion where that works and where that doesn't work, and whether a ger can be done dini mominus or can only be done other gerim. It's a whole discussion in Rishonim. So, but if you say that a ger can be done at least other gerim, so then one would imagine that it should work here also. So here he's being done a prospective ger, so a ger on that Beis Din should be valid. And that is the position a number of poskim took, but there were those who disagreed. And most prominently, Rabbi Yashiv. Rabbi Yashiv felt it wasn't good at all. Many others felt differently. So that's a big discussion whether a ger can be one of the dayanim on a Beis Din for the process of gerus. Rabbi Michal Zilberman has a essay about this. It's a short essay in a Sefer Tov Lev. It's a short essay with a lot of content. He quotes a lot of the later Mechabrim on both sides of the question who address this issue. Shlomo?
Don't we say that once someone converts that we consider them a full Jew? So when Rashi says Yisrael, Shlosha Yisraelim, why can't we say that that means specifically even someone who converted? Like, why are we saying that he's in the status of ger for his whole life, or we consider him now a Yisrael after he converts?
So it's a good question. In some, it depends really on the context, because in some other contexts we find the word Yisrael meaning davka, born a Yisrael on both sides. In some contexts we find it meaning something else. So you're right that the diokir is arguable, and there are those who have questioned whether or not that's the only way to read this Rashi. But there are other reasons also, so it's a debate about this question. So what that brings about is a big suffix. So therefore, as a matter of policy, it certainly would be indicated that one should not have a ger and a Beis Din of ger, especially because it's so easily avoidable. And it's going to bring up a suffix, which is not in anybody's interest. After the fact, there are definitely great poskim who accepted it, so it's a tricky situation to be in. So certainly, l'chadchila, you would want to avoid it because of the machlokas, but that's a whole discussion, as Rav Shechter discusses in the Ginas Egos. So it also brings up the question of what exactly the Beis Din is doing, that if it's a type of mishpat, if they are evaluating this guy, so then, if it's comparable, let's say, to Dini Mominus, the Mishpat, so a ger should be able to be done, ger chavero, it should be valid. So maybe it sounds like that there's something more to it, and that they are supposed to represent all of Klal Yisrael here. And if that's the case, maybe it's a different kind of standard. And that's a part of what he discusses over there. So this all goes back to the question which we've alluded to a few times also, which a number of Achronim discuss, as to what exactly is the function of the Beis Din. Is the Beis Din there to assess something? Is the Beis Din there just to sign off on something? Is the Beis Din there as a posek? Is the Beis Din there as a representation? It's what we've seen from the various explanations here, and what we've seen also from some of the questions that come up. So we've mentioned a few issues in the past. I think in the day one or day two, we mentioned Rav Asher Weiss's tshuva about what if the Beis Din in that area decides that this candidate is not going to be a good fit for this community, that there are issues outside of sincerity and commitment that are going to pose a problem. Is that something that they're allowed to factor in? And he gets into that discussion there also. Again, is the Beis Din just there to witness, or just there to be the public representation, or are they actually assessing something? And then a separate tshuva, so this is in Chelek Aleph and Siman Nun Aleph, he talks about the question of, let's say you had a woman who deceived the Beis Din. She came in front of the Beis Din and she said that she was born Jewish, but there was a suffix, so she wants a gerus l'chumra. So it turns out it's not really true, that really it's just a complete gerus. So, okay, there's no practical difference between a geris l'chumra and a geris, the same process. So, does it matter? Does it matter that Beis Din didn't really know the whole story? So he discusses in that context the question also, is the Beis Din paskening somehow here? So therefore, they have to really get the facts accurately presented to them. And if not, then that's a problem. Or are they just carrying out a formal function, but they're not really acting as a Beis Din that is paskening? In a similar vein, Rav Ben Sion Nesher, in one of his chuvas, in his chuvas Avin Pina, so he talks about, is it crucial that the Beis Din and the Ger speak the same language? What if they're dealing through interpreters and the Beis Din can't actually communicate directly, or can't actually understand directly the Ger? So he brings in that question again, what exactly the Beis Din is trying to accomplish. And there he assumes you should have at least one person on the Beis Din who actually does speak the language of the candidate, because indeed that might be necessary for their evaluation. As far as the Lamdas is concerned, so just to kind of sum it up, in that piece in the Ginos Egos, Rav Schechter assumes that basically it's Eidus L'Kiyum Hadavar, that the Beis Din is there just to establish the formal acceptance, and therefore they're not paskening anything. And in a sense, that makes it more chumra when he started off with that question of whether a ger can be on the Beis Din, that if it was about them paskening dine mamonis or something like that, so then the ger could be a part of that Beis Din. But because that's not the kind of role, so therefore it's not going to be enough. The Ragachavar in the Sefer Tzofnas Panech and the Rambam Hilchos Yisurei Bia, so he happens to understand it's a combination of both, that the Beis Din needs to paskin on this ger and also to perform the Maisa Geris as a formality. So there's a lot of lumbus here, a lot of conceptualization, and it has some impact, has a lot of impact on some of the practicalities, and we see there are a lot of controversial issues. So, l'chachila, we want to try to avoid all the controversies. After the fact, it's not always possible, and it gets some very difficult situations for people in very significant real-life scenarios. So we have to try to do all we can to try to minimize potential machlokas and all of the very real agmas nefesh that can come along with that. Okay, so let's try to recap a little bit what we spoke about. So we saw that the Gemara Nivamba says that there's a requirement of a Beis Din because it's called Mishpat, and there's some discussion about what exactly the Beis Din is necessary for. That's part of what we've seen. And also, how crucial is the Beis Din? Is it a l'chachila, or is it b'dieved as well? And then we got into the question of what's the concept? What is the Beis Din supposed to accomplish theoretically? And we saw some who understood that it's representing the Shechina in making this pact with the Ger. That's how Rav Soloveitchik understood, and how his great-grandfather Beis Halevi understood, talking about Avram, and how Rav Schechter discusses what was happening at Har Sinai, why there was no Beis Din there, and yet we learned the halachos from Har Sinai, is because the Shechina there was doing the same thing as the Beis Din. And the Chavos Ben Yamin understood a little differently, that it's there because of the Kabbalah requirement, that you need Klal Yisrael to be Mekabel, this person, and it can't be against their will, and it's an act of acceptance. We know to Rav Schulte's point also that it has to be with their knowledge that they are comprising a Beis Din. And then we got into the question of Smuchim, that we know we don't have Smuchim Bizman Azad, no offense, so the question is, if you require smuchim for geiris, so then what do we do? Knowing that the Gemara also says geiris has to always be possible. So two approaches in Rishonim, either you don't need smuchim, or we invoke shlichusayu. So Rav Cook explained further that whole idea of shlichusayu. We talked a little bit tangentially about what shlichusayu means. We noted that that's a whole discussion, probably not shlichus, probably something else, even though the language sounds like it's about shlichus. But one way or another, it's a mechanism, the Gemara says, that can allow for Batei Din to function nowadays without smuchim, but usually it's limited to something that is shchiach and something that's shabbat mamon. So Rav Kook explains how both of those could be tweaked to fit geiris, but that's assuming that it's a schus. If somebody is going to convert and not accept the mitzvah, so then that would undermine both of those points, and the shlichu sayu wouldn't be so effective. And that got us into the question in general, what's the impact on the dayanim if the Kabbalah HaMitzvos is not there or is not sincere? We mentioned Rav Shlomo Zalman's tshuva about how there's an issue of Lifnei Iver, and you noted this was a part of a great controversy, a very painful controversy in Eretz Yisrael about 13 years ago, the question of whether if a Beis Din doesn't insist on Kabbalah's mitzvahs to some degree or another, so is that something which could passel the dayanim, and then does that have an impact even on the garrison that are sincere and committed? And there's a whole... it's a whole mess that came out of that. And then we got into the question, it's really a broader question, are the dayanim and their personal statures going to be relevant at all after the fact, b'di'evit? So Rav Soloveitchik was always worried, b'di'evit, that maybe the geiris is valid because of the Shultik Yibarim that we mentioned and other such factors. Rav Moshe was more machmir, but still thought there were things to be considered in some situations. And then we talked about the issue of a geiris serving on the Beis Din itself for geiris, and how Rav Yalo pointed out from the Rashi in Kedushin that it sounds like it has to be a born Jew to serve on the Beis Din. Other Achronim had other issues with it. This was a major machlokas with big poskim on both sides, that many poskim saying it's okay, but a significant minority being concerned, so, and including Rabbi Yashiv, so certainly lechachila, that's a complication nobody wants, so that's not a good policy to take on, but that's a whole subject of discussion. And it also touches to the question of what exactly the Beis Din is doing. Is the Beis Din paskening, or is the Beis Din representing something? And that question of the Beis Din does, you mentioned a few other cases that impact that. What if the Beis Din wants to reject somebody based on other factors that are not about commitment or motivation? Or what if it turns out that the person fooled the Beis Din on some level? So does that disqualify the geiris, or does it really matter what the Beis Din understands or doesn't understand about the situation? And then that led also to the question of a language issue. What if the language is spoken that the Beis Din doesn't understand? Is that a problem? And then we just ended off by noting, as far as the question of what the Beis Din is accomplishing, so as Rav Schechter asserts in this essay, that it's not some type of a psak, it is there as a kiyum hadavar, and the Tzafnos Paneach said a little differently, that it's both, a maisa Beis Din, and that the Beis Din is passing on this person and their qualifications. Okay, so a lot of sensitive machlokasin in this issue, so I've got to be very careful to try to avoid the machlokasin whenever possible, and just to be aware of what some of the sensitive issues are, and also to constantly be appreciative of the fact that this impacts real people in their real lives in a very serious way. So you have to really be very careful as to how to approach this issue, both l'chachil and b'diavid, both before the fact and after the fact. And God willing, tomorrow we'll start off with a more focused approach on the topic of Kabbalah HaMitzvos and what role exactly that has in the whole process. Okay, so I wish everyone a successful day. It should be only good things. And I will see you, God willing, tomorrow.
Very cool question.
Yes, sir. What a question?
The rub being choshish for the Shiltei Giborim, is that in Ginas Ekkos also?
No, but Rav Schechter quotes it in Nefesh HaRav, I believe.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yishkoach.
Have a good day.
Have a good day.